From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, the Dream Dictionary. Here's what's happening. A top federal health official is issuing a very dire warning. It's coming from him following the recommended coronavirus measures or risk having the worst fall in U.S. public health history. The coronavirus has infected already more than 5 million people, they say, and killed more than 166,000 people nationwide, according to the Johns Hopkins University. There were 55,910 reported new cases and 1,499 deaths, the highest number of fatalities since May on Wednesday alone. Now, this is what Robert Redfield, doctor, director of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, says. For your country right now and for the war that we're in against COVID, I'm asking you to do four simple things. Wear a mask, social distance, wash your hands, and be smart about crowds. And that's coming again from the guy who heads up the CDC. Why do some people experience depression while others simply don't, even when they're under the same circumstances? Figuring out what makes someone more prone to clinical depression continues to be one of the most pressing questions for researchers and mental health professionals. Dr. Peter Breggin, our resident psychiatrist, with us here. Peter, that's an interesting question. Some people get depressed, other people don't. Same circumstances. How come?
Well, first, George, we never know. People have the same circumstances. I've sometimes worked with whole families or people who grew up in the same family, and you'd think they lived in different worlds. So it's a myth that, you know, one person, that anybody has the same circumstances as anybody else. But I do have a partial answer to this.
All right.
And the first thing is to not think about it as a disorder or a disease, that there's this thing, depression, that's biological, it's not, genetic, it's not, hereditary, it's not. Pretty much everybody struggles with some kind of feeling like depression, of giving up, of feeling down and out, of feeling helpless, feeling hopeless, and overwhelmed. And I think the key I often work with my patients, is to look at when you started to feel helpless, when you felt overwhelmed, when whatever happened to you first made you just give up on loving life, being loved, being involved, and being engaged. Very often, it's a childhood that has certain experiences in it that are getting re-stimulated for some reason or another. Maybe you had a big loss in your childhood, your caretaker, your mother, your father, and you have a loss now, and it just becomes overwhelming because you fall back into the helplessness. So that's the big key, George, is to look into ourselves and say, okay, I got to find out why in the world I'm losing it right now. And it can be about anxiety, it can be about what we call depression. All these things are manifestations of how hard it is to be a human being and how hard it is to live. And ultimately, you begin the recovery when you can find in yourself the determination, the hope that you can actually start loving life again, start getting involved again.
Thank you. One of Peter's books, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, his website, Breggin, BREGGIN.com. It's part of our Twitter feed, by the way, at coasttocoastam.com. President Trump has announced what he called a historic peace agreement between Israel and the United Arab Emirates, saying that they agreed to full normalization of relations. It is a dramatic story. Israel and the UAE also said they'll continue their efforts to achieve a just, comprehensive, and enduring resolution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Now, if the United Arab Emirates would just not keep funding terrorism to keep the crime and the terrorism away from their areas, we'd be better off. The Justice Department seized $2 million worth of cryptocurrency from terror groups in the Middle East, according to federal prosecutors, making the largest ever U.S. government takeover of online terrorist financing. The funds from ISIS, Al-Qaeda, and the Al-Qassam Brigades, the military wing of Hamas, would likely have been used by the groups to buy weapons and train would-be attackers, according to the Justice Department. More than 1,200 Amazon delivery drivers are slated to lose their jobs within the next few months after the shopping giant has cut ties with small delivery companies across the country. Seven companies, part of Amazon's Delivery Service Partner Program, are the ones that got hit. A swarm of minor earthquakes, as we reported last week, near California's Salton Sea, is raising concern about the potential for a large earthquake at the state's San Andreas Fault. Let's check in with Cal Ori, the author of The Man Who Predicts Earthquakes, about the late Jim Berkland. Cal, what do you think? Is a big one due?
Well, you know, I did predict this back in January for my annual.
Yes, you did.
Yeah, I did, right there. And I'm looking on the internet right now. You're right. The USGS has warned the San Andreas swarm. It started off aggressive, more than 100 quakes on the 10th. It could put California at risk of big earthquakes for over a week. I didn't know that. I always, you know, when I look at aggressive swarms, I get a vibe as an earthquake sensitive. And oftentimes it does create a larger quake, you know, within a short time. But I didn't know they put a warning out. And you knew that? You knew that?
Yeah. Absolutely.
Well, the cool thing is they do have that little warning system that we talked about before.
That's right.
And it did work this time. It gives you about 10 to 20 seconds. So if you're at the dentist office or the fire, what do you call it? The door won't shut so the fire engines can get out because oftentimes there's fires after an earthquake. So we do have that warning system. And remember Jim Berkland, he would be...
Oh, I love the guy. I miss him. He sure would. Well, but do you think the big one's coming?
I know it's coming. We all know it's coming. And as I said, it's not a matter of if, it's when. For the next week... I'll give it stronger than the 4.6, okay? I'm not going to say it's a 7.8 yet. It would be terrible timing with the pandemic, but I'm going to give it 60% odds we're going to have a major quake, 7.0 or stronger, right in that vicinity, Southern California, before the year is over.
Wow, just what we need. Cal, thank you so much. Cal Ori. In the news at coasttocoastam.com, take a look at this story. The world's most powerful telescope at Arecibo in Puerto Rico is damaged after cable snapped, and it created a 100-foot hole in the radio telescope. Now, Arecibo was one of the spots that Seth Shostak from SETI was at when I was doing my local St. Louis show years ago, and I interviewed him while he was just right out there. So the world's most powerful telescope at Arecibo in Puerto Rico has been damaged after the cable snapped, creating a 100-foot hole. You can see that story at coasttocoastam.com in the news. Up next, Ivor Davis back with us. A couple of his books include The Beatles and Me on Tour, Manson Exposed. We're going to be talking about the anniversary dates of Elvis Presley dying and the Manson murders. Ivor Davis next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. We've got a great show for you tonight. Let me tell you a little bit about Ivor Davis. He was back with me just about 7-8 months ago. London-born Ivor Davis first came to America in the early 60s and was appointed the West Coast correspondent for the London Daily Express. That was back in 1963. His first big assignment came the following year to hang out, travel, and get to know the tour members of a new pop group from Liverpool, the Beatles. How about that? And 50 years later, Davis wrote The Beatles and Me on Tour. And for more than five decades as a writer for The Express and The Times of London, Ivor covered major events in North America here. He penned a weekly entertainment column for the New York Times Syndicate for more than 15 years. And back in 1969, he co-wrote Five to Die, the first book ever published about the Sharon Tate, LaBianca murders, and covered the trial for the Daily Express. Here he is back on Coast to Coast, Ivor Davis, with a couple anniversary dates this month. Ivor, welcome back, my friend.
Good to be back, George, indeed. Thank you.
By the way, I just love your work. Yeah, I mean, you have been so instrumental in giving us great information about these rock groups and about music and about these tragedies. You just do a fantastic job, and I just want you to know that.
Thank you.
Let's start with the anniversary of Elvis Presley. I mean, here we go, 43 years. He died at the age of 42, died August 16th, 1977. We're coming up on 43 years, more years than he was alive on this tragedy. What happened to the guy? I mean, he was grossly obese. He was popping pills like crazy, died of a heart attack. But what was happening to him?
Well, one of the things that that your early guest said this morning triggered a thought. Your doctor, the psychologist,
yes,
psychiatrist, said talked about depression, and suddenly it rang a bell, almost as if I had forgotten it. And it's this, that Elvis, many of his fans know, or maybe they don't know, was a twin. And his older brother was born, and he died right away. And Elvis survived. They didn't even know that at that time that Elvis was there in Gladys. And so Elvis sort of lived throughout his life with some kind of guilt, and the psychiatrist would have a field day with this, of course. And this may have explained his drive to be someone. And then, of course, as those who followed his amazing career know that, in decline, and unfortunately I did see him in decline. He did exactly as you said. He had prescription drugs, and the fact that the doctors gave it to him was okay. It wasn't really. And then, of course, he died, as you said, in Graceland, the incredible estate that he lived in the bathroom, in at such a young age. And it seems like many personalities die too young. I mean, look at Michael Jackson, because Michael Jackson,
oh my God,
George, Michael was actually Elvis's son-in-law. Yes, because he married Lisa Marie, and of course Elvis wasn't around to hear that. Anyway, I've gone on a little bit, but George.
Great information. I want to get into later how Elvis met the Beatles, because that was an interesting situation. I've always been told that the Beatles, McCartney especially, and John Lennon, were very disappointed. They thought of Elvis as their hero, and when they had a first-time meeting with him, they were somewhat disappointed over the way that he treated him. Is that a true story, do you know, Ivor?
It is a true story, because I was fortunate enough to be at the Presley house when I went along with the Beatles to meet him.
Oh, my God, you were there?
I was there, yes, I was there. And the circumstances, in a nutshell, it was that in 1964 they wanted to meet Elvis. Of course, John Lennon grew up with Heartbreak Hotel and Blue Suede Shoes and was a great fan, and so were the rest of them. Paul was a great fan of Presley. But the first year, 1964, everybody was too busy. Elvis was making movie after movie. The Beatles were racing around the country on this incredible tour of 64, their first. And then 1965, I got a call in the August of 1965, and they said, Mal Evans, their roadie, said, come over here, we're going over to meet Elvis. And indeed, we did go over to meet Elvis. And I was the fly on the wall, and I must tell you, you would have thought that they warmed up to each other very quickly, but the problem was the Beatles were in awe of Elvis, and Elvis is not really Mr. Social Animal.
Right.
So they sat around for 10 minutes or more, not saying anything, watching a television with no sound, Elvis sitting there looking like Elvis in his mansion in Beverly Hills, and finally Elvis jumped up and said, hey, you guys, because nobody had said anything, nobody had made the introductions. Elvis finally said, hey, you guys, I'm going to bed, unless you guys want to jam. Well, that broke the ice. They jammed, and they started getting a lot more friendly. But
yeah,
it didn't get off to a flying start.
Wasn't Elvis a little jealous of the Beatles' instant success?
You have absolutely hit the nail on the head. I mean, we didn't realize it at the time, but there was a certain degree of resentment for the reasons you've just said. Elvis was king. Elvis no longer was king, but these upstarts from Liverpool had come along and knocked him off. And then, to add insult to injury, Elvis made three cookie-cutter movies every year. The same movie, he said. He had a new leading lady, he beat up the bad guy, he got the girl, and he said, I sang 10 terrible songs. So he was in a bit of a slough of despond, if you like. And the Beatles were riding high. And the Beatles made one movie, A Hard Day's Night, and that was a sensation. So there was the elements of resentment and jealousy, and Elvis thought these guys, he was a little bit upset at them.
And it's what's so amazing is Elvis did to Frank Sinatra as the Beatles did to Elvis, because Sinatra's era was going out the door. Elvis was coming in and was the new king of Vegas, where Sinatra used to be. There was that tension, too. I remember as a kid, there was a TV show with Sinatra and Elvis Presley singing together to try to break the ice. But it was ironic because there was Sinatra, then Elvis knocked him out, and then the Beatles came and knocked out Elvis.
Yeah, well, there's always going to be a kind of a pecking order. And as you said, I think Sinatra did all right, even after Elvis knocked him off.
He did. He did.
But certainly at that particular moment when we showed up at the house, there was a feeling of, I think, jealousy. And as I said, Elvis wasn't a hell fellow, well-met type of guy. And the Beatles were, as I said, in awe. So nobody could kind of, they were sort of dancing around each other in a rather uncomfortable dance until Elvis said let's play music, and they did. But you know, that's the nature of showbiz. There's a king one day, and the next minute he's been sent off to exile.
Hey, do you still have Paul McCartney's cell phone number?
I will give it to you after the show.
Well, I'll have you call him to see one day if he wants to be on with you. Okay.
Of course. That would be fun.
And then how's his health and how's Ringo's health?
Well, I want to tell you, I went to see Paul about 7 months ago before we went into lockdown. I went to Petco Stadium in San Diego. And I want to tell you that Paul McCartney, at his not-so-tender age, performed for 3 hours and 15 minutes nonstop. He stayed on stage. He looked terrific. He does have a terrific backup group, and the show is somewhat more spectacular to the Paul McCartney that I saw with the Beatles back in 64 when there were just four of them. And he looked good. And Nancy's got a fairly new bride. So he looked in fine fettle. And I'll tell you one other quick story, because I went backstage to see him.
Yeah.
He said, I asked him, in the old days, you used to travel around in an old, beat-up old car with no back seat, with two road managers. When you go on the road, Paul, how many road managers do you have? He said, "We're not so much road managers. We've got 92 staff members, and we don't travel in the beat-up old car. We travel in the jumbo jet." So Paul has come a long way, baby.
Who was the brilliant one, Ivor, who grabbed the Beatles records and the library because they were worth a fortune?
Well, I'm not sure I quite understand the question, George, but do you mean somebody who had the intelligence to collect Beatle records in the old days? Is that what you mean?
Well, no. So somebody who, you know, when the Beatles would do their songs, of course, whoever owned them, whether it was the record company or the Beatles themselves, but wasn't it Lennon who was the one who said, no, let's own them ourselves. This library is going to be worth a fortune.
Yes. Well, yes, you're right. Here's the situation. Believe it or not, in those days, the Beatles' financial savvy was not very good. And they virtually were sort of financially pummeled. And then years later, once Paul McCartney teamed up with the Eastman family, married their daughter Linda, and the Eastmans were showbiz attorneys, once that happened, suddenly Paul said, I'm going to buy our music. And he did buy their music, and he did accumulate a great deal of the stuff. But in the early days, the Beatles didn't have a clue about finances, about owning their own music. The music was sold. And believe it or not, at one time, Michael Jackson, who was quite savvy on that front, bought the Beatles' music. And then a few years later, Paul McCartney bought the Beatles' music back from him at an added amount. So they weren't that savvy about the finances of the rock world.
Would Elvis, who would be in his mid-80s right about now, had he survived, do you think he'd still be playing?
I think he probably would still be playing. I'm not too sure. When I last saw him play at the Las Vegas Hilton Hotel, his voice was a bit stringy. And, of course, as you said earlier in our conversation, George, he was looking a bit puffy around the middle.
Yeah.
So if he'd polished his act up, if he'd, you know, got on the wagon or got off of drugs, he could have been. I mean, look at Tom Jones.
Absolutely. Stay with us, Ivor. We're going to take a quick break. We'll come back, talk a little bit more about Elvis, and then we'll get into the Manson murders, all these anniversaries, all this month. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Ivor Davis with us. His website is linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Ivor, tragedy last month, of course, with Elvis's grandson committing suicide. It was very sad. He was just, and again, that magical age of 27 that so many musicians and singers and stars have died at.
Yes, it is tragic. And to be honest with you, having covered Hollywood for a long time, there's been many stories of the offspring of the famous who, for whatever reason, decide to kill themselves. I mean, it's a tragedy, and a shrink would do a better job than I am. But if you look back over the history of Hollywood, I remember Marlon Brando's daughter Cheyenne hanged herself, and so many. Paul Newman's son died from a drug overdose. And I can go through and catalog so many famous men and women who lost their children. I don't know whether it's a psychological thing with the kids, because they know possibly that they will never emulate their famous parents.
Mm-hmm.
But as I say, I'm not a shrink, and I don't really want to go there. But certainly, I think even with common sense, you can see what the problem might be. Frank Sinatra Jr. was terrific as a singer. But again, who's gonna top Frank?
Absolutely. 51 years ago, the tragedy of the Tate-LaBianca murders occurring over a couple days in August of 1969. Five people murdered under the direction of Charlie Manson. And what a tragedy that was. You were one of, tell me how you got involved in that story.
Well, on August the 9th of that year, of 1969, my office in London called me and said, get over to a house on Cielo Drive in Beverly Hills, because there's been a bunch of murders. And it was a kind of high-rent district. Off I went. And when I arrived at this gated community, there were dozens and dozens of police. They were holding us back, of course. And it took about 2 or 3 hours before we realized the owners of the house and who lived there, and they were Sharon Tate and Roman Polanski. Her husband was in England at the time. Sharon Tate, J.C. Bring, a famous hairdresser to the movie stars like Steve McQueen and Paul Newman. Wojtek Frykowski, a friend of Polanski, and his girlfriend Abigail Folger, who was an heiress to the coffee fortune, and a young man who just happened to be at the wrong place at the wrong time named Stephen Perrin. And when we learned who it was, we didn't know. Hollywood was in a panic. They wondered if this was just a random bunch of murders. And then the rumors came out. It could have been drugs. It could have been voodoo. It could have been black magic. It could have been a mafia hit. And then finally, as the world knows, we learned gradually that it was the Charles Manson family responsible for this carnage, and the responsible for the carnage 24 hours after Sharon was killed of Lino and Rosemary LaBianca, a grocery store chain owners who also were killed in a terrible fashion.
And wasn't Charlie Manson a frustrated musician? He wanted the Beach Boys to do something for him, and he just went nuts when they rejected him?
Well, a part of that is true. Manson definitely in jail learned to play the guitar. He wrote music, and he by pure happenstance, managed to become friendly with Dennis Wilson of the Beach Boys. What actually happened was Wilson picked up a couple of Manson girls. The Manson girls called Charlie. Charlie thought, aha, Dennis Wilson of the Beach Boys. And the next morning when Dennis got back to his house, Charlie Manson and his black bus and the girls had sort of moved in almost. But the amazing thing was that Dennis Wilson of the Beach Boys and Charlie Manson hit it off. They both thought they could help each other. But, of course, Manson was just taking horrible advantage of Dennis, although Dennis, who was on drugs and all sorts of stuff, was not quite 100%, quite frankly, and allowed Manson to move into his house. So that was the situation. And Manson, as you mentioned a moment ago when you asked the question, desperately wanted to become a rock star or well-known in the rock world.
Absolutely. Manson, of course, now dead, serving a life in prison for being part of all of this. The actual murderers, Tex Watson is 74 in a San Diego penitentiary. Susan Atkins, she's dead. Patricia Krenwinkel, she's 72 years old and is the longest in prison woman alive right at this point. Watson and Krenwinkel keep trying for parole. They're never going to get it, but what even makes them think they're eligible?
Well, they are eligible, and they obviously think we want to get out. And there's also Leslie Van Houten, who was only involved in the murders of the LaBiancas, and she has been trying, like the rest of them, to get parole. I must say that after about 20 times of being declined parole, Manson finally said, I'm never going to get it. Home is jail for me. But the others try, and they do get for parole by the parole board, but 99 out of 100 times the governor of California, whoever he happens to be at the time, has declined to let them free. And that's the way it's going to be, and I'm afraid this is the way, or not afraid, I believe this is the way it's going to continue until they probably end up dying in jail.
Whatever happened to the house on Cielo Drive in L.A.? Is it still there?
No. Well, it is and it isn't. It was after the murders, it was a notorious place. I think a rock singer, whose name escapes me for the moment, lived there. And then the new owners who bought the property ripped it down and built a completely new house, and the murder address was changed to a different address. Although very often if you take a Hollywood tour, they'll take you past the new Cielo Drive house, which is completely, completely different to the way it was at the time of the murders.
God, was there ever any remorse from Charlie Manson? I don't think so. He had the strange look every time people interviewed him, didn't he?
You are absolutely right. Remorse, he didn't know the word. What he kept saying when anybody asked him, and in the 60s, in the 70s, in the 80s, in the 90s, a lot of the top flight TV interviewers, Tom Snyder and people like that, came to see Charlie. And Charlie, when asked if he had remorse, said, I don't even know what the word means. And why should I be remorseful, said he. Gosh. I never killed anybody. Of course, he never killed anybody in the Sharon Tate house, and neither did he do to the LaBiancas, but he did tie the LaBiancas up and then told his acolytes to go in and kill. So until his dying day, Manson was never remorseful, never even admitted he was guilty.
It's just amazing. It'd been back to the Elvis Presley story, of course, and his tragedy, of course, when they found him dead at the very young age of 42 years old. He truly was just out of control, I think, his shape. I remember seeing a clip of Elvis in Vegas singing, Are You Lonely Tonight? And he was singing like this, Ivor, Are You Lonely Tonight? I mean, it was horrible.
Well, of course, it was terrible that you saw him that way, because if you look at some of the old movies, he's actually very good. And, of course, in the early days, he was fantastic. But he was surrounded by enablers. I mean, with all due respect to the Memphis Mafia, his buddies, they never would lay the law down because they would be kicked out. And at least the Beatles had each other to lean on, but mm-hmm. Elvis didn't have anybody. And so he had doctors who were willing to write him prescriptions, and he didn't sleep, and he was depressed, and all the terrible, terrible symptoms obviously resulted in this awful early death.
We're going to take calls with Ivor next hour, folks, about everything we're talking about right now. And so if you're into the music scene, get ready to make your calls. What was it about the Beatles that caused them to break up when they were at the pinnacle of their career?
Well, it's very simple. Number one, Brian Epstein, the manager, the man who took them from the cavern in Liverpool to international stardom, had died, and they really missed him. He was a friend. He was a headmaster to them. If there was a question that they were arguing, Brian was the ultimate decision maker. And then, of course, John married or got together with Yoko, and I think it was a fairly natural breakout, a breakup, because not only did John go his way with Yoko, his new wife, Paul wanted to do his own thing. George Harrison decided he didn't want to be a Beatle. He wanted to be George Harrison, singer, composer. And Ringo, of course, teamed up with George and with John on one side, and Paul was on the other side, and they each got their own managers, and the managers didn't get along. And I think it was fairly inevitable that it would have happened without the glue that was Brian Epstein to hold them together.
What year did they come over and sing on the Ed Sullivan Show? It was the early 60s, for sure.
Yes. What happened, George, was Brian Epstein knew Ed Sullivan could be his passport to fame and success in America. So, first of all, in November 1963, soon after John Kennedy was assassinated, he came to New York to try and woo and talk to Ed Sullivan. He finally met Ed Sullivan. Ed Sullivan said, okay, I'll put the boys on the show. They may not get star billing, argued Epstein, why not? And then in February of 1969, they came over, they did the Ed Sullivan Show, 74 million viewers tuned into that show.
Huge, huge.
It is huge. It is huge. And, of course, as soon as the screaming and as soon as Brian Epstein saw what a phenomenal reaction the Beatles had, 6 months, 5 months later, they were on a plane over to New York, and that's when I joined them in San Francisco in August of 1964 for a phenomenal, successful trip, 35 cities, so many concerts, tour a day, and that was a triumphant conquest of America by this group called the Beatles.
I know our parents hated their haircuts because everybody started growing their hair a little longer than we used to.
That's indeed true. But what was funny about going to every concert was that I met many young women who insisted that Paul, George, Ringo, and Paul were in love with them, and they went to see them and scream at them, and they
yep.
claimed to me that the Beatles waved back at them, all 15,000 of them.
December 8th, 1980, John Lennon shot to death outside his apartment by Mark David Chapman, who was still in prison. Would you ever like to interview him?
Not particularly. I think he obviously is mentally disturbed. I mean, there are pictures of him greeting John warmly hours before he killed him.
He got an autograph, didn't he?
Yes, I think he did. I think you're right. So, I'm sure he was mentally deranged. Does that explain it? Who knows? But contemplate the idea of John Lennon being alive today at the age of 80 or thereabouts. It's hard to imagine what would he have achieved if he'd lived longer. I don't know. A lot.
Who was the brains behind the outfit? Was it Lennon, McCartney, or both of them?
I think they were a fantastic team. I would be on the tour, and I'd go into their suite, and they would be sitting on the floor writing music. Just like that. And they also... I mean, John was a provoker. He loved to, a provocateur, I should say.
Yeah.
He loved to needle you. Paul was a much nicer, sweeter guy at the time, but their combo was unbelievable. And what astonished me was how fast the two of them wrote a hit song. It was unbelievable.
Oh, my God. And they were great, great songs.
Oh, and they bounced off each other. They were great songs. We still sing them today, and they were a phenomenal team, a duo of songwriters.
Were you with any of them when Elvis was killed, when Elvis died?
No, I wasn't.
I wasn't there.
I can't even remember where they were. I think they were in England at the time. But I think I'd heard, of course, they were pretty shattered. Because even though they weren't bosom buddies with Elvis, they knew he was a pioneer, if you like. And he, they sort of almost, modeled themselves on him and other singers of that era. And they grew up with Elvis, although Elvis was not that much older than them.
Why was it that so many people had the rumors of Elvis still being alive after he had died?
It's the same as the people who say that Paul McCartney was killed at a younger age, and that they put a doppelganger, they put somebody to impersonate. I mean, there are so many wild rumors that go around, particularly in Hollywood and particularly involving showbiz people. I think it's a little bit crazy, but I think when he died, Elvis left the building.
I guess people just don't want to let go of these people who were their superstars.
I think that's probably a good assessment of why they refuse to acknowledge the death. But it happened.
Benjamin Keough, Elvis's grandson, who committed suicide last month, as we talked about, was just 27. But he looked almost identical to Elvis, didn't he?
It was a phenomenal. If you look at the pictures of the young man, it was. You could see he was the offspring. I mean, genes will out. And as you said, look at the pictures of this young man. I don't think he was a songwriter. Did he want to emulate Elvis? I'm sure to some extent, but I don't know what went on in his mind. But again, a terrible tragedy
for a
famous family.
And his mother was Lisa Marie Presley, Elvis's daughter. What a tragedy for all of them, as you say.
Absolutely, yes.
It just doesn't stop. So what are you doing these days, Ivor?
Well, I'm talking to you, which is always fun. It's always fun because I love being on with you because, you're a great guy to have a conversation with. And then all my friends from all over the country call up and say, hey, I saw you on George's show. So I heard you on George's show, and so it's kind of fun, and it's great. People who I'd never heard of for 20 years call me up or contact me and say, you were on with George, and I say, well, what a huge depth of knowledge he has, and what a great, great audience he has all over.
Well, I love it when you're on because it makes me refresh myself and get back into some of these great stories. And when I was reading up on the Beatles and their meeting with Elvis Presley, I said, this is great. And the fact that you were there must have been exciting for you.
Well, it was, but you had to realize that Brian Epstein, believe it or not, as canny as he was, and Colonel Parker, who was Elvis's manager and sort of slave owner, I say that because he did make Elvis work very hard, and
Elvis, believe it or not, did
at the Hilton Hotel 800 performances at the Hilton Hotel in Las Vegas. They were both bright men, and yet Brian Epstein, and I saw the letter he wrote. He said, we do not want to make this a media frenzy. We don't want to invite the press. Don't invite anybody. Not one single photograph for what was rock and roll history. I still don't understand it today, but and why they did it, but they did it.
Ivor, when we come back, I want to take some phone calls with you for the final hour. And also I want to ask you about Elvis meeting Liberace, because I have been told that Liberace had a lot to do with trying to get Elvis into uniforms and costumes and dressed up and stuff like that. We'll be back in a moment.